Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Advertising may be in digital flux, but still, the more people see an ad, the better the chance it will stick. With so many screens competing for consumer attention, marketers go to great, even extreme lengths to get their message out there. Case in point, think Moto's viral ad for the remake of the movie Carrie. If you were not among the nearly 59 million who watched it on YouTube, here's the gist. Hidden cameras are set up in a crowded New York City coffee shop. Two actors get into an altercation over a spilled beverage.
Oh my God!
That sucks. I'm sorry.
You just ruined all of my stuff!
The female actor becomes enraged, and through telekinetic powers and the help of a pulley system, some rigged tables, and remote-controlled books, she smashes the male actor against the wall and raises him till he's up hovering 4 feet in the air. She then sends chairs and tables skittering across the floor and violently shakes books from the shelves, all while scaring the bejesus out of the customers.
Just get away from me!
As entertaining as these prank ads may be, are marketers just ratcheting up the ante on shock value? Are they effective? Are they even ethical? To help answer these questions, David Greiner's with us. He's social editor for Adweek and co-editor of Ad Freak. David, great to have you back on Word of Mouth.
Oh, it's great to be back.
So how did we go from Calgon take me away to a possessed lady in a coffee shop? When did this pranksterizing start?
Well, you know, it's funny if you think about it. This idea of pranks, pulling pranks on your customers, dates back forever. But in the late 70s, you had the Folgers switch, right, at Brennan's, and switching their coffee
right.
for Folgers crystals. And it's one of those classic advertising moments. What's changed is that mentality stayed the same. What's changed is that you don't need a really expensive national TV to make the most of that anymore. You can just go put your money into the prank and then throw it on YouTube for free and just watch the views roll in.
How effective are they? You obviously get a lot of views, but does that translate to sales?
It seems like they're consistently effective for things like a movie, which has a lot of a movie's success is going to hinge on its opening weekend box office. And so to get a viral hit out there and to get millions of views in a short span of time on a pretty small budget is a real coup for some of these lesser-known horror movies, like the Carrie remake and some of the others we've seen. It seems to really help goose their opening weekend. They don't end up being blockbusters. We're not talking the Avengers here. But for those small movies, that probably makes a pretty big difference for recouping at least what they invested in making it.
What have been some of the most effective prank ads?
Well, I think when you talk about prank ads, you are largely talking these days about the Carrie telekinesis stunt, the Devil Baby stunt that was for a movie called The Devil's Due. And a lot of those are coming out of the same agency, a place called Thinkmoto, who've really mastered this art of making these really clever, somewhat cruel pranks that generate a lot of attention, a lot of publicity very quickly. And while I don't have access to their numbers, it seems like those have traditionally been the ones that get the most buzz and get the most attention for the brands and for the shows they're marketing.
You have to just describe briefly Devil Baby, if you don't mind.
So Devil Baby is almost to me one of the meanest of all the prank advertising, and is definitely one of the most successful. They made a robotic little demon baby that was in a stroller. They pushed the stroller was just kind of left in different parts of New York, and when people would come up because they'd hear the crying of this abandoned baby in a stroller, which any of us hopefully would go check on, you go over, and all of a sudden this demonic-looking baby sits up and starts screaming and vomiting and rolling around on its own, and everyone's screaming, and of course they played it, you know, they recorded the reaction.
It's pretty funny. But as you said, I want to talk about that fine line between cruelty and funny. I mean, people at that coffee shop are pretty freaked out. I think the Devil Baby people kind of realize that they're being pranked. But is everybody so good-natured at the reveal?
It really comes down to the safety of the participants and making sure that no one's going to be physically hurt. We've been told repeatedly by the folks who make these videos that that's their number one priority, that you know, anything else is kind of open for interpretation of whether it's real, whether it's fake, but they do a lot to ensure the safety. Now, the does that necessarily mean that it's not cruel to the people involved? No, I think there is some cruelty there. They're probably not scarred for life. Maybe one or two are. But largely, I think it's just one of those jump scare. It's almost like turning the world into a haunted house, except you don't know when something's going to jump out from behind a corner at you. I think they've definitely come very close to being too cruel, but finding that line is obviously the real balance.
Any liability suits on record for being freaked out, hurt, you know, awakening PTSD even possibly?
I haven't personally seen any. We had Adweek hosts a weekly live chat on Twitter called Adweek Chat, and we had a lawyer actually weigh in and say that, you know, the reason that a lot of people say, oh, this seems fake or there seem to be actors, he says, because, you know, there are some liability issues there that you want to be careful with. And so I think they go out of their way to ensure as best they can, especially when they know it's going to be a really intense experience for one person, that that's someone who is not in a fragile mental state.
Well, laughing is one thing, jumping up and down, and sharing, of course. Sharing is the thing that we're all supposed to do to make these viral. How are we complicit in the propagation of the prankstervising model?
I think that, you know, anytime you share one of these, whether you're saying something positive or negative about it, you're encouraging marketers to keep doing more of it. And what's unfortunate to me is that we are seeing some, you know, and I don't think this necessarily the marketers doing this, but we're seeing more and more prank videos that are not being done by advertisers. They're just done by normal people pulling jokes. They're sometimes very cruel. And I have personally told some friends, you know, you really need to think twice about some of these videos you're sharing, even if you're saying this is horrible. And when you share these things, you are giving it a stamp of approval and you're giving it more views. You're making it more likely you'll see more along those lines.
Any prank ads you think have gone too far, David?
They haven't gone too far yet because no one's been necessarily hurt. There was one for a high-definition television where people were led into what they thought was a job interview, and then in the background what they thought was a window and was an HDTV, and they see a nuclear bomb hit in the background and start exploding. Of course, they freak out and dive for cover, as you probably would. I personally thought that when watching Line. Now, was it real? Did those people really not know what was going on? It's hard to say. But I think convincing people that they're watching the end of the world happen is maybe a little harsh. But again, the way to think about it is if you see their face, if it's not blurred out, then they agreed at some point to be part of it. And I'm sure they probably get a nice little payout, too, for being involved.
We watched a couple of prank ads from other places, from Denmark, one from Belgium. Is the liability or the appetite for this different in different countries, do you think?
I think the moral or the goal of what they're trying to get out of it definitely varies by country. You know, we've seen one really powerful ad to raise the attention of children in Syria who were suffering by having a young boy in a Scandinavian country sit on a bus bench with no coat and just looking very, very cold. And all the passersby, well, not all, but quite a few who came by offered him a coat, offered to take care of him. And then at the end it says, you know, that they're basically trying to highlight that just because you don't see kids suffering doesn't mean they're not. Mm. That was a tremendously effective use of a prank. I don't know if that was specific to, you know, Scandinavian country versus here. I like to think it would work just as well, but that's something that maybe came out of a slightly different culture of pranks than what is currently really popular in America.
As we continue to see these, do you think the audience is going to eventually hit a saturation point or always be looking over their shoulder for the camera?
I think right now you're probably smart to always be skeptical. I know we at the magazine and our readers have debated whether this is kind of hurting our culture and making us, you know, less likely to help an abandoned baby carriage if you think, oh, that's probably a prank. And I think all of us have already gotten to the point where if we saw money just sitting out, we probably would be reluctant to take it for fear that it's some sort of prank or some kind of gag. So I worry that it could be changing us and making us a little more overly skeptical, especially when you have a prank like the one where the elevator door opens and you see a guy murdering another guy. We already have a bystander problem of people walking past people in trouble. I don't think we need more encouragement for people to ignore other people because it might be a gag.
And that, by the way, was the prank ad for Dead Man Down, another horror film. David Greiner, thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
David Greiner, social editor for Adweek and co-editor of Ad Freak. If you'd like to see some of the extreme prank ads that he highlighted, we've compiled them on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. advertising isn't the only place where the line between entertainment and ethics gets fuzzy. When Word of Mouth continues, a profile of a comedian whose penchant for prank calls has earned him a spot on Comedy Central's Crank Yankers and a visit from the NYPD. Stay with us for that story after the break. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. While advertisers may be staging elaborate pranks to attract the eyes of consumers, we now turn to the prank that once ruled them all, the crank call.
Most haven't.
Is Mr. Freely there?
Who?
Freely. First initial is IP.
Hold on, I'll check. Is IP Freely here? Hey, everybody, IP Freely.
Wait a minute. Listen to me, you lousy bum. When I get home to you, you're dead. I swear I'm gonna slice your heart in half.
Back when having a phone book still mattered, crank calling was as easy as picking up the old rotary phone and dialing. But between caller ID, unlisted numbers, and the proliferation of mobile phones, pranking is no longer so easy. That doesn't mean it's completely disappeared. It's just become more specialized. Our prankstervising segment reminded us of a conversation our senior producer Maureen McMurray had with one of the kings of the pranksters.
Jim Florentine is a stand-up comic, Howard Stern regular, and host of VH1's That Metal Show. If his name doesn't ring a bell, his voice might. He was one of the guys behind Comedy Central's Crank Yankers, you know, that show about the pranking puppets.
Hi, Rich. It's Bobby Fletcher. I'm calling about the job.
What type of sales experience you got?
I've sold everything over the phone.
Name it. You've done it?
Right.
Well, basically what we're doing here, guy, is dealing specifically with, not specifically, taxes. Are you burping?
What?
All right. So that's a pretty good example of what Jim Florentine does best. Like any good prank caller, he is unflappable. He lets things get to this extremely awkward point and never breaks character. But it's actually his early work in the years before he got a paycheck from pranking that I find most compelling. When he was living with a bunch of buddies in a small apartment, passing the time between stand-up gigs with an ingenious prank.
I originally started doing prank calls when I was a kid because I was always grounded for being bad. So I was stuck in the house and I had nothing better to do than to pick the phone and just call people and bother them. So I started that as a little kid, and then it morphed into being a comic years later. And, you know, as a comedian, I had a show at like 10 o'clock at night. I had nothing going on during the day. So whenever a telemarketer would call, I would just sit by my phone and wait for him, you know, to call. And then I would just try to keep him on the phone as long as possible because I had nowhere to go. So I would try to keep him on the phone for like an hour if I could.
Hello?
Hello, James?
Yeah.
I'm giving you a call from credit counselor.
Hello? Hello?
Yeah. Hey, dude, you still on the phone?
Yeah, I'm still on the phone.
Okay.
Hello?
All right, do you have a few moments? Or...
Yeah, I have a few moments, yeah.
Yo, you still on the phone?
Yeah.
Okay. Debt consolidation is a program. Yo, you still on, dude?
Yeah.
You on the phone?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, if you want, I can give you a call back.
No, this is fine, actually. I got to run out to work a little bit, so I'd rather get this over with now. It was what? Developed what?
Debt consolidation is a program.
Yo, you still on? Yeah.
Okay.
Turns out those calls that he made for his own enjoyment to pass the time between stand-up gigs is what wound up putting him on the map. Howard Stern caught wind of his pranks, and Jim put out a 5-volume series of these pranks called Terrorizing Telemarketers. And he made all of these pranks with one thing in mind. Keep the telemarketers on the line as long as possible. And keeping them on the line actually wasn't that hard.
As long as you don't curse or tell them you don't want the product, they pretty much have to stay on the line because they usually got a supervisor listening in. And, you know, they just had 10 people in a row going, you know, F you, don't ever call here again. So they finally get somebody on the phone. They're like, wow, somebody's actually listening and I got somebody. So they're excited.
Did you find that there was a typical response that you would get?
Well, my whole thing was, you know, if they were ready to leave, you know, get off the call and say, look, sir, we'll just call you tomorrow or we'll... I got to go. Just like my whole thing was, I'm just trying to get the information. I don't know how this works.
This is frustrating.
I'm reading from a strip, and I know exactly what I just stated.
The part right before the debt relief you said, what was that?
We are the exclusive agents.
No,
national.
No, no.
You're throwing me for loops right here, and that's all that I have stated.
Okay, but you said that one three times. I told you that wasn't it.
Okay, then let me go on to proceed further then.
Okay.
Now, because we are a nonprofit company.
No, no.
Now, because we are a nonprofit company, we are able to guarantee.
It's not that. No, it's not that part, though. I heard that.
I'm moving on from that.
No, no.
Well, bye, sir, because you still hide it. No, and I can't. I'm not taking this from you today.
She hung up.
And that's it. Without cursing, without resorting to threats, Jim simply plays dumb to the point of making the harasser the harassed. It's remarkable and it's hilarious. I laughed the first time I heard it. I still think it's funny. But is it mean? Am I mean for thinking it's funny? Do you ever feel a bit bad for some of these people?
No, no, because they rip people off. Most of their plans are bogus. You know, they're scams. They're bothering people all the time. They rip off old people constantly. You know, what about the people like, go, F you, don't ever call here again, I hate you. You know, that's got to make somebody feel bad on the telemarketer, like, oh, my God, everybody hates me.
Okay, well, maybe he does have a point, but does it even matter? I mean, why does the prankster have to bear the burden of guilt in the scenario? But what happens when the prank goes too far? I mean, even Jim admits he doesn't know where the line is, and his line, it is way different from ours.
Even with the telemarketer calls, you just never know. Like, there was another telemarketer call that went wrong where my credit card company called me up and said, look, we can transfer $10,000 from my credit card into your bank account in case, you know. And I'm like, okay, and I'm listening. And I'm like, all right. She goes, and then all of a sudden she goes, you know, in case something comes up, maybe you needed the money. And right away when she said that, I go, oh, you know, that's perfect. I just hit this old lady with my car and I got to pay her medical bills.
I just found out I hit that old lady. That hit and run, but...
Oh, well, I hope everything works out all right for you.
Yeah, everything's fine with me. I don't know what's going on with her.
Mm.
Well, she's old.
Now, did you have any other balances out there that you wanted to pay off?
Yeah, because you know what? I'm going to have to pick up this old bag's medical expenses.
Mm-hmm.
And the woman's like, okay. And I'm like, I go, let me go over these bills real quick. Let me see if this works because this might be good. And then I just started making stuff up. I said, yeah, I visited her at the hospital and I knocked her teeth out, so I got to buy her new teeth. How much are new teeth? Like fake teeth. And the woman's actually going over the prices with me over the phone.
We can take care of that for you right now unless you would like me to try you back at a later time.
No, no. I mean, I'm just trying to figure this all out, if you can give me a second.
Okay.
The dentures, what would you say that goes for?
Couldn't tell you how much the dentures will cost.
All right, so the hearing aid is, I don't know, what do you say, grand for two of them, maybe?
Yeah, maybe.
$1,500?
Maybe a little bit more than that.
All right, let's go $2,000 with
okay.
it.
Okay.
Finally, at the end of the call, she's like, okay, what's your account number so we can transfer the money? Now, I don't want them to transfer the money, obviously, so now I got to get out of it. So I'm thinking, how can I get out of this? So I just blurted out. I go,
you know what? $7,050, I got to pay for this. I think it's just cheaper to just go kill her. Hello?
Okay. I can admit that probably is a line crossed for most people. I was uncomfortable. But in his defense, I will speak in his defense, I mean, this wasn't planned. And he just said the first thing that came into his mind. And as a professional comedian, sometimes what's on the top of your mind might be dark. I mean, you push boundaries for a living. So what wound up happening here is the woman hangs up the phone. Jim thinks, all right, I got out of that situation. She didn't transfer the money into my account. Everything's good. Prank is a success. And then this happens.
45 minutes later, I got two detectives at my door because it was my credit card company that had my address right in front of them. The woman believed it, that I was going to go kill this woman in a hospital. And two detectives are knocking on my door. And they, you know, came in and started searching my house and looking in rooms because I thought there was like an old lady's dead body in there. And now I'm trying to explain to them. I go, look, I do these prank calls. I work on this show called Crank Anchors. And they have my license. They're looking at it, checking everything out. And the guy just looked at it. He goes, you're 32 years old. What is wrong with you?
But here's the thing. Jim's in his 40s now, and he has a wife and a kid. And he's still making prank calls. He's still a stand-up comic. And I bet he still thinks that joke is funny. He'll probably always think that joke is funny. But thank goodness for someone like Jim. Because you know what? The prank call, in the way that we knew it as kids, is dead. We have caller ID. We have phone tracking systems. We have unlisted numbers. Those innocent prank calls we made as kids, those don't exist anymore. Maybe a good prank needs someone like Jim Florentine who will say the things that we won't. And we'll go to the places we won't. And we'll go to the lengths that we just won't to get a laugh. All in the name of keeping the prank call alive.
Just doing my thing.
That's from an earlier conversation between Maureen McMurray and professional prankster and stand-up comic Jim Florentine. And we move from childish antics to childhood memories. Or are they? Up next, we're going to find out why our brains do not form accurate memories until we reach the age of 7. First, the news.
Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Think back to your earliest childhood memory. Now try to remember how old you were when that happened. Current research tells us that our earliest accurate memories come from around 7 years old. A recent study expands on that, finding that two-year-olds may have clear recollection of events that happened up to months before, but those memories then disappear. So what happens, and what are we hiding from ourselves? Kristen Olson is a freelance writer whose work has appeared in the New York Times, Salon, New Scientist, and other places. We found her article, The Great Forgetting, on Eon.com. That's where she explored the science behind and the impact of childhood amnesia. Kristen, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi. Nice to be talking with you.
Well, it's such an interesting article, and it seems so universal. Everybody wants to recall the earliest parts of our lives, but doesn't seem to be able to. Are our brains just not that equipped to dig into the past?
I don't think it's that our brains aren't equipped to dig into the past, but those earliest memories, those moments that happened when we were really just starting to form and coalesce as human beings, our brains really weren't capable of holding on to the things that happened and putting it into permanent memory.
Well, before we knew so much about the brain, Freud called the phenomenon childhood amnesia, that sort of forgetting of the early years. When do these childhood memories start to appear and to vanish?
Well, children at, you know, at the age of 2 and 3 and 4 can have very strong memories of things that happened even 2 years before. So it's not that children don't form memories, but as time moves on, they don't hold on to them unless those memories are really reinforced by a family environment, parents that keep revisiting and inviting children to talk about those memories and tell the stories about things that happened then. But for the most part, the machinery in our brains at that age just doesn't exist to hold on to them.
Well, how about this idea of smell, the olfactory sense being really connected to memory? I mean, I've turned around on the street when I've smelled a perfume that my grandmother used to wear.
Well, one of the things that I wrote about in my piece was having to go to bed early at night, long before my older brothers and sisters did, and smelling the wave of popcorn wonder coming down the hallways and going out in the morning and searching around in the living room for popcorn kernels. It's possible that I remember that memory because it was so strongly tied into a sense of smell. Mm.
Well, that's just plain cruel, by the way. You mentioned that even though we don't remember the specifics of a moment, there is something that is left behind in our subconscious. Now, what do you mean by that? How do we parse that out?
The way that Patricia Bauer, who is a very prominent researcher into memory, puts it is that we don't retain the specifics, but we retain a feeling about certain things. Like she says, you don't recall the exact details of when Uncle Henry and Aunt Stella came to visit, but you recall that you have a feeling, you grow up with a feeling that visiting relatives are fun and something to be looked forward to.
We talked about story, and of course there are some cultures that are more prone to storytelling than others. Are there cultures that remember childhood differently?
There are certainly cultures that that have a tendency to reinforce individual memories better. So one of the researchers that I spoke to, Carol Peterson from Canada, she did a study with some Chinese researchers to compare the early childhood memories from China versus early childhood memories in Canada. And the result was that children in China had fewer of those early childhood memories. And the feeling of the researchers, or the conclusion of the researchers, was that China doesn't, as a culture, prize individuality as much as North America does, so that they, so that the families wouldn't have had necessarily that kind of cultural imperative to have a young child really focus on what happened to them. They would be maybe more focused on what was happening with the family as a whole, or what was happening with the town or neighborhood as a whole, but not that individual life. Mm-hmm. And then there have been, there's some other research showing, for instance, that in Italian families, when you compare the children coming from extended families where there's a lot of relatives sort of clustered on site and a lot of discussion of what everybody is doing, that the early childhood memories from those children were stronger than the ones from Italian families where they didn't live in an extended family situation.
Mm, so interesting. We're talking about the elusiveness of childhood memories with Kristen Olson. She wrote about her own experiences of trying to recall childhood and some of the recent research on what happens to memories formed in childhood. You mentioned earlier that our brains, ourselves, just aren't attuned to or can't hold on to memories when we're really young. Is there anything self-protective about that? You know, something that might keep us from remembering maybe something painful earlier in life?
I don't get that impression from talking to the researchers. It's just, you know, it just seems to be more the case that there are just pieces of our brain that have not developed, that just aren't able to carry out in that function. I mean, I think another interesting possibility is that we are learning so much when we are children, and research shows that the process of learning can erase things that have already been learned.
Mm-hmm. Well, children are obviously learning so much when they are young. They're taking so much in, including a sense of who they are in the world, and, you know, days by days by days. I wonder if that has anything to do with how they remember, that they even have a sense of, I don't know, chronology.
Well, children don't have a sense of chronology. Children are lacking many of the tools that they will have later on that helps us form a memory of something and hang on to that memory. So children don't have a good sense of chronology. Children don't have the really developed language that helps them construct a narrative about something that happened. A lot of that stuff comes later on. Apparently, there's a period of time from the age of 15 to 30 that researchers called the reminiscence bump. And that's when we as humans really form our strongest memories. That's when we're sort of examining the world and thinking about our place in it and trying to figure out who we are. That's when we have, you know, really a strong sense of chronology and strong language skills to be able to describe and even maybe even write down those things that have happened. So those are the those are the strongest memories that we carry throughout life, and they really can overshadow all the memories that we form later on. You know, we tend to go through life thinking, I mean, we all do this, you know, the foods that we ate back then were just the best, and the music back then was just the best, and the people that we fell in love with, the people that we were best friends with, those were the times that were just the best. It may not be true, but those are the memories that are strongest throughout our life.
Yes, I've gone back to eat a bowl of Cocoa Puffs and found out that they really aren't very good at all.
It's always nice when we go back and find that something really does stand up to the test of time, like going back to read C.S. Lewis's Narnia series. They're still pretty damn good.
Kristen, can you recall your earliest memory?
Unfortunately, I think a lot of my earliest memories are just wrong. They're not my memories. They're things that other people have remembered for me. I remember I came from a family of small-town Republicans in California. Mm-hmm. I remember saying, I like Ike, and having everybody be very excited about that. But I'm not sure how old I was. I think maybe around one, maybe around one and a half.
Thanks so much for speaking with us today.
Really fun to talk about this stuff. It's fascinating material.
It certainly is. And Kristen Olson is a freelance writer and author of the book, The Soil Will Save Us. We found her article, The Great Forgetting, at aeon.com. You'll find a link to read it for yourself at wordofmouthradio.org. Now, our next story comes to us from Jeff Ingram, who's suffering from a rare type of amnesia called dissociative fugue. Whenever he has an attack, his memory is wiped clean. He doesn't remember who he is or where he's from. So each time he has to start his life over, and his wife Penny is there to help him remember. At StoryCorps, Penny told Jeff about the early days of their relationship.
You and I were talking on the phone. He said, well, I have a medical condition that I probably should share with you. And so you told me about when you went missing for 9 months. And we both agreed that if that were to happen again, we could handle that. I said, I would be your memory. And eventually you called my mom and asked if you could have my hand in marriage.
You've told me that story several times, and I really wish I could remember that.
The first time you had an amnesia event with me, we woke up that day, said goodbye, and you jumped on the freeway. No one knows what happened from that point forward because you ended up in Denver. I was going crazy, but eventually you got on TV and asked America to help you find out who you are.
What's the last thing you remember before you came to and realized you were in the middle of Denver?
Just picking myself up off the ground. Outside of a building, downtown Denver.
Do you know if you'd ever been to Denver before? Do you know if you're from Denver?
No, I don't.
You remember nothing about your past life?
No, nothing prior to September the 10th.
So I ended up calling the Denver Police Department, and that's when they told you who you were. We talked on the phone. I said, hi, I'm Penny, your fiance. You asked, did we have kids? What was your life like? It was like meeting you again for the first time. And when you came home, I didn't know what to do, and so I offered to sleep in the spare room, considering you didn't know me. But when you were home for a while, you called my mother again and asked her for my hand in marriage. And my mom's like, I already told you, yes. And so we got married on New Year's Eve.
That's my biggest regret about having these episodes, is that I forgot that.
We'll do it again. So you can remember it.
Jeff Ingram, who suffers from a rare form of amnesia, and his wife Penny there in Olympia, Washington. They came to StoryCorps to record Jeff's memories, just in case he loses them again. And we're going to continue with the story of a New Hampshire family that's downsizing in a major way. Breck and Beck Palumbo have just sold most of their belongings and moved themselves and their three young children out of a 3,000-square-foot home in Exeter and into a 240-square-foot RV. They're not downsizing because they have to, but because they want to. NHPR Seacoast reporter Emily Corwin recently paid him a visit.
Breck Palumbo runs a software company from a home office. He and his wife, Becky, a stay-at-home mom, have cultivated a kind of flexibility their parents never dreamed of. They can live anywhere they want to. The problem is, they haven't found that perfect place.
And then we thought, well, why don't we just go find where we should be?
Like a lot of middle-class families untethered to offices thanks to the internet, the Palumbos are searching for the there, a place to put down roots.
I mean, I'd like to have more people in the kind of business that I'm in.
Local food scene, good restaurants.
Outdoor recreation.
Some alternative school options.
People who have the same sort of values.
So the Palumbos are setting out for a year with their three kids and a dog in a shiny Airstream RV.
This is called a safari bunk. It's just shy of 31 feet.
pretty much everything in here folds. Breck has a folding monitor he plugs into his folding laptop. The kitchen cutting board folds down, even the couch.
So this folds down to a bed, and this is where Enzo will sleep, he's not quite two.
The bunks are in the back.
This is where I sometimes sleep, and that's where Madeline sometimes sleeps.
Vince is five. He calls his sister Mollen.
My name is Madeline, and I am 7 years old.
They're setting off this week, heading south for the winter, west to California, then up along the Pacific coast next spring.
So we're starting in Old Orchard Beach, then we're going to go to Great Barrington, Raystown Lake, Gettysburg, Asheville, maybe Atlanta, Austin, Portland. I really want to get to Victoria, BC. After that, I don't care what happens.
Left behind in New Hampshire are 7-year-old Madeline's school and friends. From now on, this silver Airstream will be her schoolhouse, and little Vince, her only classmate.
So you've never done homeschool before. Are you excited about it?
Yes.
What are you excited about?
That my parents will be my teachers.
You gonna miss having lots of little kids around like you do at school?
Kind of.
The Palumbos are not the only family traversing the country with kids in an RV. In fact, there's a whole movement of so-called road schoolers. The website familiesontheroad.com has a list of 320 families who've homeschooled from their RVs over the last 10 years. This family's adventure is about more than just finding that perfect place with good people and plenty of local food. For Breck and Becky, this giant year-long adventure is in part an ideological rebellion.
I'm really looking forward to having our schedule be entirely our own.
Breck and Becky don't like the expectations of modern middle-class parenthood. Not the standardized tests, not the after-school activities, and especially not all the stuff that comes with it. So the Palumbos spent the summer purging.
So I got this bucket, the baby got that bucket, and Vince got that bucket.
Each kid went from a bedroom full of stuff to one small plastic bucket. Madeline points out the things she didn't give away.
This doll, my bunny, I put some little dollhouse characters, I put my diary.
Becky is hopeful their new life will be simpler, easier.
As the stay-at-home mom, I feel like so much of my day is spent taking care of our stuff. In a smaller space, I am sort of looking, it's going to be an interesting experiment. It's a lot smaller of a space to take care of.
But like she says, it's an experiment. In 2012, another road schooling family with three kids returned to San Diego after 2 years on the road. Father Jason Robillard says living with less is simpler, but it's certainly not serene.
It's very chaotic because you have so many people crammed into a small area. It is difficult to have any sort of private time or quiet time away from everybody else.
7-year-old Madeline and 5-year-old Vince have no idea what to expect on their great big American adventure.
Climbing a cactus. Then one part of the year it will be like just baby animals, baby animals, baby animals, baby animals.
But I suppose their parents don't really know what they're getting into either. For Word of Mouth, I'm Emily Corwin.
You can attend school remotely, you can work remotely, and possibly even learn to practice surgery remotely. Up next, virtual reality's role in training the surgeons of tomorrow. That's when Word of Mouth continues.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Reality TV shows like The Swan or dramas like Grey's Anatomy and The Nick feed audiences that cannot get enough of the operating theater. What if you could get a front row seat to a real live knee replacement or heart bypass surgery? Would you take it? Jamin Warren is founder of Killscreen and host of the PBS digital short Game Show. He's here to tell us about the role that video games and virtual reality might play in training tomorrow's surgeons and entertaining everybody else. Hello, Jamin.
Hello, how are you doing?
Very well. We read on Killscreen about the first virtual reality captured surgery. Can you tell us what it was and why is it such a big deal?
Sure. It was performed in France by a doctor named Thomas Gregory. It's part of a larger project that's part of something called the Movio Foundation. What they do is they fund different projects that are sort of at the edge of medicine, interactive technologies, kind of the future of different types of medical practices. So it's recorded from a head-mounted camera, which tapes from a bunch of different angles. And what it allows is for someone to basically embody the role of what it's like to be a surgeon. They can look left. They can look right. They obviously don't have control over the hands. That's been pre-recorded, although perhaps that might be something in the works someday. But it allows them to see from first person what it might be like to perform a surgery. And hopefully that type of knowledge attained will make it less scary or less stressful when they actually have to do the real thing. Part one of the other big challenges is that for the attending surgeons, they're busy. They're, you know, helping the chief surgeon, the one who's performing the surgery. They don't have time to sort of sit and watch over. But really what this allows, what virtual reality allows to happen is for not just surgeons, but any kind of complex first-person experience. Virtual reality allows us to record those experiences and then to play them back for other people.
So surgical students, you mentioned first responders. Do you think the general public is going to be interested in seeing a virtual reality surgery?
That's a great question. You know, it's funny, on YouTube, there are lots of really popular videos of different surgical procedures. There's kind of there's definitely a voyeur's mentality. And, that wouldn't be too surprising to me that, you know, some of the shows that you mentioned, a show like The Nick, that maybe someday some, you know, virtual interactive performance of that might involve someone wearing a virtual reality headset and watching over what it would be like to go under surgery. I suspect it might be useful for people maybe who have a fear of, you know, going under anesthesia, perhaps, who want to see what it might be like before they actually have to go and make the jump themselves. But
oh my gosh, I don't know if that would be helpful to me one bit.
Me neither.
This is the first virtual reality capture of an operation, not the first point of view recording. That's been done before.
Yeah.
But what about this kind of immersive experience? What kind of role might that actually play in the future of medicine?
Well, I mean, I could certainly see it as a way for to sort of transition some of the book learning that happens, for doctors in training. I mean, my mother is a doctor, so I remember her pouring through reams and reams and reams of different textbooks. But obviously that doesn't replace the actual experience of being a surgeon and having to cut open your first patient. You know, obviously, performing live surgeries is not something that can just be sort of done at will, but being able to record those experiences in virtual reality, those can be distributed around the world digitally. It allows for people to sort of train, you know, basically to train with the best. If you have one of the best surgeons in the world and you train them performing a particularly complicated surgery, that's now information that's recorded, captured, and can now be distributed to future medical students everywhere.
Jamin, I was digging back a little bit on your Killscreen website and noticed a posting that said both high school sophomores who played video games an average of 2 hours per day and college students who played 4 hours a day matched and in some cases exceeded the skills of residents working on surgeries. So do medical residents use games in order to prepare themselves for surgery?
Well, I think one of the things that you're seeing is, you know, with advances in medical technology, that some of the tools that are being used in surgery, whether it's like arthroscopic surgery, for example, they're using, you know, joystick-like structures. They're using their fingers in a way, in a dexterous manner that might be similar to, you know, perhaps playing a video game. So I think that that's a big piece of what you're seeing there is a comfort with young people who play a lot of video games, the comfort with their thumbs that's now being translated into other fields.
Jamin Warren is founder of Killscreen and host of the PBS digital short Game Show. You'd like to see a particularly clumsy but highly entertaining surgery simulator, and we promise you, you do want to see it. You can visit our website, wordofmouthradio.org.
Oh, you blew it!
My turn.
Take out asparagus for $100.
It takes a steady hand because if you touch the side...
Here goes a funny bone.
Well, that's all we have time for today. Earlier in the show, we talked about a growing trend among marketers called prankstervising. That's when ad agencies set up hidden cameras and often scare the heck out of passersby or otherwise surprise them in hopes of capturing some raw, unfiltered human emotion and that video will go viral. If you'd like to see some examples, we've compiled a few of the most extreme at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. We can only protect ourselves from such marketing assaults by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Join us for more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2 on New Hampshire Public Radio.